Okay, folks, we are just coming up on 7:30, so as usual, I'll go ahead now and I will mute all. And also, as usual, everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question. And remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck in PDF format, along with the audio track and the contents of the chat window, will go up on our website, courtesy of Alan's Hard Work. Once again, if we have any new people with us tonight, welcome. We welcome guests at any time at the ROPC user group meetings. However, you might have seen in the intro deck that while we welcome guests at any time, what if everybody tried to be a guest? We wouldn't last very long. So if you find value in the ROPC user group and it's worth $20 a year for you, I have pasted into the chat window how you can go to a link on our website and join up. You can also go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew button along the top. And with that, again, welcome all. And we've got a few items. We hopefully will have time for the final 10. So if you have any burning questions, by all means, throw them into the chat, or you can ask them audibly after the main presentation. And with that, I will throw it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, and I'm going to throw it right back because the first item is a follow-up on the CrowdStrike issue for Chris.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. Just paste in, whoops. I'm just busy pasting into the chat window the link from this item. So I think everybody is well aware of the fact that CrowdStrike Falcon incident did happen. Certainly anybody who was flying anywhere ran into it. And it was a pretty big impact that happened. And Steve Gibson does a Security Now podcast once a week, and always entertaining, and he's an interesting character for sure. Next. So in this podcast that happened on the 30th of July, he had an analysis on how CrowdStrike Falcon actually works and what it is about the way that it works that caused the problem, and what actually did go wrong in the way that CrowdStrike handled an update. And a really interesting thing about this was that he noted how CrowdStrike was actually able to mitigate a whole bunch of systems through a cloud service. And it was sort of a race when you rebooted a system, whether it crashed or it was able to get a configuration update from CrowdStrike before the crash. But in a lot of cases, they were able to get the system would actually get an update that fixed the problem before the actual crash happened. That was kind of neat. He talked extensively about the processes that have been put in place to make sure that this doesn't happen again. Next. And what I found really fascinating about the podcast was that they talked to a lot of CrowdStrike Falcon customers. So these are the people in the IT trenches who are actually running CrowdStrike Falcon to protect networks. And all of the Falcon customers were saying that the CrowdStrike Falcon service is absolutely best of breed. There's nothing even comes close to it. They say that in second place, and it's a distant second place, is Microsoft Defender for Endpoint. And then they were saying that even though there was a lot of problems that were caused by this, all of them seem to have ample evidence that CrowdStrike Falcon has actually saved their company many, many times. And they said that support was actually exemplary, much, much better than they get from Microsoft through Microsoft Defender for Endpoint. And they were able to talk to people. They were able to get good advice and so forth through the whole incident. And the final thing that I thought was really cool was that there was not a single listener that is a CrowdStrike customer who would prefer to operate without CrowdStrike protection in the future. So none of them were abandoning CrowdStrike Falcon as the means to protect their network. So even though bad things can happen, you might still be in a better position than not having that particular service. And in the case of CrowdStrike Falcon, that seems to be the case, is that people who know it know that it's the best of breed product, and it is far and away going to do more good for them than it is harm. So it was kind of cool. So if you want to watch the Security Now podcast, the link is in the chat, and it's really quite fascinating to listen through it. That's it.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. And our next item comes from the user forum, actually. And you may note that when we have material, we will post people's name to give them credit for the information, unless they want to remain anonymous. And this gentleman, although he's a very valued member, that's what he wanted to be denoted as. So, so he posted this in the chat, and he says that on one day he got a call from somebody with an Indian accent that told him because he was such a good Bell customer, they wanted to make sure that he wasn't going to go to the competition, and they were going to lower his fees by 50% for 6 months. And then they just needed to verify a few details and ask him for, and then he hung up. And then the next day, he gets another call from somebody from Bell with another Indian accent, this time with a very poor connection. And they tell him that they're installing Bell Fiber in the neighborhood. But unfortunately, that means they're going to be disconnecting landlines. But there's no problem because he's such a great customer of Bell. They're going to provide him with a special super fast router free of charge. And then she's going to hand him over to a tech guy who wants to verify that his computer is compatible by basically logging on remotely into his system. So he hangs up again. And he notes that, interesting that they're installing Bell Fiber in the neighborhood because it's been there for 2 years. And so his final comment was, what will tomorrow bring? So there's a cautionary tale when people phone up and be aware that the scammers are everywhere and they're trying to catch you out with all kinds of different things. Okay, next up we have a share from Chris.
Yeah, I came across this, which I thought was kind of neat. The NSA in the States, the spooks in the States, they actually have a two-pager out there, a PDF file, on mobile device best practices. And what's interesting is that from a security point of view, you're always talking about the balance between, the cost-benefit of having security in place. So they note that many of the features that you'll find on phones, they provide really good functionality, but they can add risks to using the phone or using that particular functionality on the phone at the same time. So you have to find the balance or find ways to mitigate the risks while still being able to take advantage of the functionality. Next. So the document lists some of the common features along with recommendations for the use. So it'll be things like Bluetooth. You know, should you have Bluetooth disabled? When should you enable it? Things like that. And then they have a chart of common threats along with what you can do to either prevent the threats from being realized or mitigate them somehow. And so the URL there is for that PDF. I highly recommend anybody with a phone download it and take a look and see if there are ways that you can tighten up the security on your phone while still taking advantage of the maximum functionality that you really want the phone for. That's it.
Okay. Okay, next up we have a question that came into the suggestion box. And this individual has a laptop that's been, well, hasn't been used for a number of years. And they had erased all the files on the hard drive. But a friend had told them that the information on the drive could still be read and suggested that they use D-band to do a secure erase. And noted that if it was a solid state drive, which it probably isn't in an old laptop, then you need to do something different. But the instructions in the PC World article turned out to be way too complicated. So they were asking, what would we suggest? So I just point out that we've had a number of newsletter articles and the odd presentation on this topic. And if you really want to know about how to delete files, then I recommend you read Chris's article, Really, Really Deleting Files, which talks about the issue of why deleted files aren't really deleted completely, or why they, how they can be recovered, I guess. And similarly, I've got one, Wipe Out Old Data, which is a bit older, but it talks about a program which will shred free space on your disk, file shredder, and also a program that will shred the entire hard drive, which is a bit like DBAN, but I suggest it's probably easier to actually use. And then the final one is a presentation I gave a while ago on the issue of secure erase and deleting files and so on and so forth. And I had this if all else fails slide. I also had a suggestion for solid state drives. And it turns out nobody took me up on this one, but if anybody has an old solid state drive that's lying around that you need securely erased, I'm quite happy to do that for you. Just send it along and I'll add it to my pile of SSDs when I want to build my super fast RAID array. Nobody took me up on that last time. I doubt anybody's going to take me up on it this time. However, DBAN, it doesn't have to be as complicated as maybe that article suggests. But you do need to know a few things. First of all, we're going to use a bootable USB. That's probably the most common things that people use for externally booting computers these days. So you need to know how to boot your computer from a USB drive. And if you don't know, then Mr. Google will almost certainly know. Or the manufacturer of the computer will know also. So you should be able to find that information on the web. And you need a USB flash drive, and it should be empty, or at least it's at least with files on it that you don't really want. Well, you don't want, because the way we're going to do this, we're going to overwrite the entire drive, and so any files that are on there will get destroyed. And the program we're going to use, which is this Balina Etcher, it doesn't actually say how large the drive has to be, but I found that the smallest one I had that worked was four gigabytes, and that worked just fine. And we're going to use this program called Balina Etcher, and the reason we're doing that is because I think this is probably the simplest program out there that will create a bootable US drive for you. I've used Rufus and I use Yumi to create multi-boot disks. Rufus does single images, Yumi does multiple images. But they need a few more bits and pieces to make them work, whereas Balina Etcher is really straightforward, as you'll see in a couple of minutes. And then the final thing, we're going to need some software that will actually do the secure erase for us. And we need to blow away all the bytes on the hard drive, basically overwrite them with zeros or random data or something, which will get rid of our personal data and replace it with zeros that don't have any useful information. And we're going to use the HD Shredder to do that. So there are the two, there's the things you need. There are the two URLs for the software that we need. And as I said, first thing you need to know is how to boot your laptop from USB. And I said Mr. Google probably knows. And sure enough, if I put in boot a Dell laptop from the USB drive, then the very first hit on the Google search page tells me to basically press F12 when I reboot the computer. That gives me a one-time boot menu. I can select the external USB drive, the bootable drive, from that menu, press enter, and it will boot into whatever software is on the drive. So that's fairly straightforward. So the next thing we have to do is download Balina Etcher. So we need to go to the URL here and go to the Balina Etcher website and basically click on the big green button there which says download Etcher. And when you do that, it basically scrolls down to the bottom of the page for you. And you see that there are versions of Galena Etcher for Windows, Mac, and Linux. And there's only one available for Windows, so clearly that's the one we want. So we download that, and it turns out it's a portable .exe file, so we don't actually have to install it, and it will basically just double click on it, and it will run just fine. But the other thing we need is an HD shredder, so we need to go to the URL here. Miray Software, the developer of HD Shredder, and hit the download button there, and that will drop down the menu, and we need to choose from the free software offerings, we need to choose HD Shredder here to download that package. And so that will give us the two packages that we need. So now we need to use File Explorer to go to the file folder where we've stored or we've downloaded the Galena Etcher software, and we'll find this file, Galena Etcher, with the current version number, setup.exe. And as I said, that's a portable version, so when you double click on that file, then it actually launches Galena Etcher directly. So you get this, this screen right here, and you basically see that, creating a bootable drive using Etcher is essentially a three-step process. And the first thing we need to do is find the file that we're going to write to the drive. In other words, we're going to look for HD Shredder. So we click on Flash from File, and that will load a file browser. So again, we need to go to the folder where we downloaded the HD Shredder ISO file. This is the file that we downloaded from the Miray Software website. We need to select HD Shredder and tell it to open. So now you can see here on the left that we've done the file select, and it's selected the HD Shredder ISO file. So now we're into the second portion where we need to select the drive that we're going to write this HD Shredder software to create the bootable drive. So we need to plug in the USB drive, the empty USB drive, or the one we want to overwrite, the target that we're going to use, and then we click on Select Target, and that will basically list all of the external drives that the software can see on the system. And you can see on my system, it actually uses an SD card, which I use for real-time backup. But it also sees this 8 GB, in this case, verbatim USB drive, which is a USB flash drive. So I selected the USB drive as the target, and now I hit this Select One button and to accept the USB drive as the target drive. And the final thing is really difficult. We hit the flash button right here, and almost off it goes. Before we can do anything, this user account control authorization screen pops up. We need to enter our Windows password to give Galena the authority to make the changes to the flash drive. So we enter the password, click yes, and now off it goes, and it's running. And you can see that there's a progress bar here. It tells us how far along it's getting with the flashing process. It's actually fairly quick. It's not a HD Shredder. It isn't a huge ISO. It's less than 200 meg. It doesn't take very long to write the thing to the drive. But then it goes into a second phase where it does a validation to make sure that it's written the ISO file correctly to the drive. So there's a second progress bar here, checking the flash drive. And then finally, it says flash completed, and it's ready to flash another, or in our case, we're done. We've created our bootable USB drive. We can now just exit out of Etcher. So we've used Etcher using that three-step process to create the bootable USB drive. We know how to boot the computer from the USB, so we go through that process. In my system, I reboot the computer, hit F12, choose the target flash drive, and it boots into this screen right here, where it's running HD Shredder as a bootable USB drive. And it, there's a information thing here which says the free edition provides basic erasing functions. But for our purposes, we just want to trash this one drive. So basic erasing is exactly what we need. That's perfect. So we'll just say close the information screen. And the options here, the one that we want is the secure deletion for the complete drive. So we're going to securely erase the complete drive on our laptop system. But remember, we're booted from the USB drive, and so we need to select the target drive. So we've got a number of things we can change here. By default, the erase mode is set to fast, so I'm quite happy. I think that probably means that it's going to do a one pass, but again, that's good enough for my purposes. I don't think any mere mortal is going to be able to recover the software from a secure erase. So I leave that as the default. I don't bother with any of the options. I do need to select the disk. So I want to select my target disk that I'm going to shred. So I need to click on this drop-down menu here, and it lists the various drives. And here you can see, actually grayed out, is my 250 gig hard drive, a solid state drive on my laptop. So in the case we're talking about, where this should be the old laptop, then we need to get rid of the hard drive from the laptop. So we can say, we can select the disk. But you notice now I cheated. I selected a different USB drive, an 8 gigabyte USB drive, just to have something that we can securely erase. But I don't actually want to trash my real hard drive, and you'll see why in just a second. So now we've selected the drive we need on the, this is the laptop's hard drive now, let's say. So we can press start, and this is why I didn't select the SSD on my drive, because it tells you that all of the information on the target drive, on the hard drive in the laptop, is going to be completely erased, and it will not be recoverable. Remember, this is a secure erase. So every byte on the drive is going to be overwritten with either a zero or random binary data, and you won't be able to get any of the information that was originally on that drive. You won't be able to get any of that information back. So make sure that you've chosen the right disk before you press continue. And when you press continue, then now it's time to go and do something else, because even though we selected fast erase, because it's overwriting every byte on the drive, it's going to take a long time. Remember, I chose a secondary USB drive, which was 8 gig, and it's estimating it's going to take 15 minutes to shred the 8 gigabytes. So if that was 800 gigabytes, if it was a terabyte, you can see that's going to take probably quite a long time. So this isn't the case where you sit in front of the computer and wait for it to finish. You probably might want to run this thing overnight and just let it rip. You can see that you get a progress bar here. Right now it's done 10%, and eventually it will wander along to the end. And when you come back, you should see this slide here, which says you've had success. The disk has been successfully erased and successfully completed. So that's basically the process. You need to know how to boot your computer. download Balina Etcher so you can create a bootable hard drive, download HD Shredder so you can create the bootable hard drive to run HD Shredder, and then when you run HD Shredder, choose the hard drive from the laptop, tell it to start, and just let it rip until it's completed. And once it's done that, then you can be pretty guaranteed that that hard drive cannot be read anymore. That's what secure erase is all about. It's securely erased.
Hey, Alan, we have a couple of questions, and I'm going to jump the queue just because I can. Can you jump back to slide 30?
I can try.
Okay, so this, you booted your laptop from the flash drive, right?
Correct.
Why is it grayed out your solid-state drive?
Because it's my laptop, and it doesn't want me to delete my hard drive.
But it should allow you to, right? I mean, that's the whole point.
Apparently it doesn't.
Yeah, I was curious as to why it's grayed out that you can't select it.
No, I tell a lie. This isn't a bootable drive. I actually installed HD Shredder on my laptop and then ran HD Shredder in Windows.
Okay. Oh, okay,
the reason
gotcha.
For doing that is I can't take screenshots if I run HD Shredder on a bootable HD drive. There's no facility in the ISO to do screenshots.
Yes.
So I cheated.
Yeah,
I installed HD Shredder on my laptop, ran it locally.
Yeah.
Now, of course, because I'm running Windows, it won't let me delete the Windows hard drive.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So if you had booted from the flash drive, it wouldn't be grayed out. Yeah. Okay. I'd also like to point out that if you do install HD Shredder, the full program, onto your computer, you can actually create the bootable flash drive from within HD Shredder. You don't have to use the other software to actually create Etcher, to actually create the bootable flash drive. You can do it from within the HD Shredder program. If you install it, within there, you can actually create the flash drive. So that can save you a little bit of time and trouble if you're actually installing the whole program. We had a question. How much space is needed on the USB drive?
I couldn't get it to run on a 250 megabyte drive, but I could get it to run on a 4 gigabyte drive.
Yeah, so you probably
4 gigabytes enough is definitely okay. Smaller than that, I don't know.
You probably can't buy a new flash drive that it won't fit on at this point.
Correct. Yeah.
Glenn asks, do the advanced deletion features in Shredder offer more security in erasing, especially on magnetic hard drives?
I don't know, but I guess I would guess they do. I should imagine that the advanced options are basically multiple passes and maybe different algorithms as well. Have you used HD Shredder recently, Chris? I don't know the answer.
I loaded the program, but I didn't explore the options or anything like that in it. Mm-hmm. Now, I will go back to a few people read my article on how to really, really delete files or hard drives. I really think that unless you've got the RCMP is knocking at your door and going to want to inspect your hard drive, or the NSA in the States has got you in their crosshairs, I really think the FastPass is more than enough for most people uses. The likelihood of anybody being able to recover anything off of that, they got to be really, really determined and using electron microscopes and things like that if they're going to actually recover data off it after any of these programs does a single fast pass on it. I think you're safe. But most of them do include the ability to do that, either multiple passes or different algorithms, things like that. There are as well different algorithms or different methods that need to be used for solid-state drives as opposed to magnetic spinning hard drives. So if you do have a solid-state drive, make sure the program you are using actually states that it's certified for use on a solid-state drive, and HD Shredder is certified that they say it does work on solid-state drives as well as magnetic spinning hard drives. And Natalie says, what if you have a dual drive SSD and HDD? You just run it twice and just select each drive in turn. Would be what you would do on that. Right, Alan?
I think so. Is that like a hybrid thing where the SSD is
I see what you mean. Yeah, okay, caching drive. Well, that's interesting. I don't know.
Select the cache separately.
Yeah, you can't actually select the cache on a caching hard drive, though. It just does it automatically. So I would think the best you could do would be to just erase the drive as it appears there, and I presume the caching portions of it are going to be involved in all of this as well anyways. But you can't actually select the cache drive or the cache portion of the drive anyways. So I don't know that I would be concerned about it, but interesting question.
Read a great big file and let it cache that and then delete the hard drive.
Apparently for the free version, one of the limitations is that it will only do 6 gigabytes a minute. So if you have a big, fast hard drive or whatever, it will run through it slowly.
Yeah.
But if you calculate how long.
Yeah, that's true. And if you're getting rid of it, does it really hurt if you end up letting it sit there for a couple of days doing its thing? I could see it in a production environment, which they actually state on this, it's for non-commercial use. But if you were using it in a production environment, that would be a concern for sure. You don't want to have drives sitting there for days on end when you have a stack of 100 drives to wipe out. But you can't use it in a commercial environment anyway. So, Ollie asks, is there someone I can pay to do this for me? It really, really isn't all that difficult, Ollie. And I really think that you would be able to follow the steps through to do it. And if you wanted to skip one of the steps, as I pointed out, if you actually install HD Shredder onto your Windows computer, and you go into the program, it'll actually offer to make that bootable flash drive for you. And so as long as you got a flash drive lying around, you just select that. And then the only tricky thing is to figure out how to boot your computer into or from the flash drive. And that, as Alan pointed out, if you just Google for how do I do this on whatever make model you've got, almost certainly somebody's got instructions on there, whether it's hitting F12 or hitting the delete key while you're booting, and then you boot from the flash drive and then just follow the instructions. It really is a very, very straightforward process.
Well, I did try following instructions for the Sony Bio, but I already erased half of my Windows. So when I tried booting it, it just kept saying that there's no operating system.
Okay.
There's no.
So you can, I presume you have another computer, right?
Well, the one I'm using right now,
So you can install HD Shredder on it or use Alan's process of creating the bootable flash drive on the computer you're using now. So there's no problem using any computer to actually create the flash drive. Yeah, either of those processes should work. So very straightforward to actually do it. I really do say that it's very, very simple. And if you want,
not simple for me, sorry.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be all that difficult. If you want, email me offline, and we could do a quick assist to get things set up. So that I can walk you through the process of getting the bootable flash drive, and then it's just a matter of booting the laptop computer that you want to wipe the drive on with that flash drive, and we could do that together over a quick assist. We can just talk through it on a phone call while this is going on, and it really is a very simple process to do it. But email me offline.
Okay, I will.
Yep. Okay.
And just a note on the Balina Etcher, the reason I use that software is because, A, I really wanted to try it. I've seen a number of people use that program to create bootable drives. And the beauty of it is it's really simple. And the second thing is you can use it to boot, to create any bootable drive. So any ISO, Linux distributions, utilities like gparted, you can use Balina Etcher to create a bootable drive for a single image. And it's three steps, really, really easy. So if you ever need a bootable drive, that's a really neat way to do it very simply, I think. Okay, now I don't know where we're up to in terms of numbers, Chris, so I'm going to have to go forwards here until I...
Oh, yeah, you're going to...
Yeah,
30,
there we are.
Yeah, 36, okay.
All right, so, yeah, and just to go back to that issue of the data being recoverable, I seem to remember in one of my articles I said that it would really only be recoverable if you were a spook and you had available an electron microscope. So don't sell your computer with a securely erased disk to a spook. That's the answer to that. Okay, now getting rid of the old drive, the old computer, Tom has a bunch of suggestions. So Tom, take it away. You have to unmute yourself first, though.
Okay. All computers still have life in them, even if they're as slow as molasses. There's a few things you can do. You can install a light version of Linux, or for that matter, Chrome. What's it called? Chrome OS Flex on it to use it as for backup access to the web, or as a web browser, or for kids, or for relatives who don't have any computer. So there are other choices, even if the Windows on it is slow and insecure. There's a variety of light visions of versions of Linux as well. Q4 OS, Slack, Ubuntu Mate, Zorin OS Lite, Xubuntu, blah, blah, blah. And if you search on, if you Google for Linux and old computer, you'll find a whole bunch of suggestions. If it doesn't work at all, then you can take apart the battery pack and you might find some still useful batteries inside, even if some of them are have gone to their maker. Many flashlights and power banks use 18650s, the common lithium cell. They're usually safe to dismantle, but wear glasses and try to avoid shorting anything. because if you short even a semi-dead cell, it can lead to bad things, maybe even a fire. So maybe some people want to avoid that, but I've done it. but I'm careful not to short anything out. And all the batteries have, as well as the batteries in them, they have a battery manager that manages all the cells and keeps them in as good balanced shape as they can. If it's too ancient, if this drive is too ancient or broken, because that's where your data is, you can drill holes through it or just take it apart for curiosity. Look inside. In fact, there's a variety of people who have used old laptops for a variety of other things. For example, you can make a light table out of the screen, and that's good for putting glass vases on and other glass sculptures. It really lights them up. But there's a variety of things on YouTube for the crafty among us. The RAM might be useful in a NAS or a firewall, because they don't usually need much RAM. And if they if the size fits, whether it's DDR4, DDR5, DDR3, check on it. You might want to save it, or you can always put stuff on eBay. Old laptops, if they work, they get a price. If they don't work, say what's wrong with them, and you might be able to sell it all by itself, or you can take out the parts from it. You can sell the screen. I would just keep the screen and the base separate, but some people need a new keyboard or need a new screen, except they can't afford a new one, so they use an old one that you can possibly supply, and eBay is fairly easy to use. It's a bit of a learning experience if you haven't used it before, but I recommend that you can get a few dollars from it. The same thing for things like Kijiji or other local sales places. Somebody out there may want what has no value to you.
Yeah, Natalie mentions here trash nothing, which is if you don't want any money for it, you can just offer it for free, and sometimes people will take it because they need the spare parts or whatever. You had one other suggestion, Tom, which is in this slide.
Yep. 17 creative uses for an old computer, of laptop or desktop. There are other things you can use it for. You could use it as a, if it's reasonable, not too old, you could use it as a media server and put Kodi or Plex on it and then have that serve your whole home or just your TV. You could turn it into if it's not a laptop, but something you can put a whole bunch of hard drives in, then you could turn it into a network attack storage device by adding a bunch of those hard disk drives or SSDs you have lying around from old computers. You could use it to create an extra hotspot or access point. If you attach it by a wire, you can set it up as an access point or a hotspot in Windows or with Linux. You could use it, for example, in your kitchen where you don't care about all the fumes turning it very dirty, and use that for showing recipes or the news or whatever. You could create your own security cam. Most laptops have a cam, and you could have that. It's kind of a very obvious security cam, but it might be useful for your purposes, or it might distract the person from the good laptop if they just steal the one that's out. You can make it into a digital photo frame, so you can just run pictures on it one after the other, so that you can see your relatives forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And you can turn it into you can turn it into art or a light box. You can put a transparency in front of it, or if you have any old Ektachrome or Kodachrome, you can turn it into a slide sorter. So there are a variety of choices. If your imagination is a limit.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. Some thoughts for old computers there. Okay, next up we have a question from B, and Chris is going to take this one.
Yeah, I'll start off with saying that I have never used WhatsApp, and so I was in the dark a little bit about this, and I must confess when I first saw the question about how do you set up WhatsApp status, I thought the question was talking about the status of the WhatsApp app. But in actual fact, WhatsApp status is actually a function of or a feature of WhatsApp. So the question was, is it safe to use that? And it came about because B had a friend in Germany wanting them to use WhatsApp status in order to be able to see their vacation photos. And she wasn't sure how to do it, and not sure if it was safe to do it or if it was asking for trouble to actually try setting that up. Next. So what is WhatsApp status? So as I said, it turns out it's actually a feature of the program, and it allows people to share multimedia updates, so photos as well as videos and things like that, updates with their contacts. And one of the features of it, I guess, is that the updates will automatically disappear after 24 hours. Next. So what you can do is share updates with all your contacts, which is the default, or all contacts except a select few or many, or only selected contacts. So you do have some control over who in your contact list you will actually have these status updates go to. Next. And when a contact actually posts a status update, when you look at the list of people in your contact list or in your group chats or participant lists or anything like that where you see a list of the people, you will see a green ring around any of your contacts that has posted a status update. Next.
Tom makes a note here that deleting after 24 hours is a choice, so I think that probably means it's an option.
Everything I read said that it happens, but I have no experience with WhatsApp, so if it's something that you can actually turn off, then that's great. I did not see that as an option in it, but good to know.
Okay. That's an option by the person who's posting the information. You can post to an individual, or you can post to a group. You can add people to the group. So it's there are choices there. It's the status is not something special. It's just whatever you post to send to a person.
Oh, okay, interesting. Yeah, because everything that I was reading on the WhatsApp FAQs and that just said it gets deleted after 24 hours. Anyhow, so both parties or all parties involved must have each other saved as contacts. So both the person posting it as well as the person who wants to see a status update, they have to be saved as a contact. If you're using the desktop app for WhatsApp, you click the icon or symbol or whatever that you see on the screen there. You can see other people's statuses, but you can't create one using the desktop app. So in order to see somebody else's status, you click the contact under Recent to view the status, and you'll see that green ring, which I showed in the previous slide, around the profile picture for the person. And then basically you just go and you only see the green ring if you haven't seen the status already. As soon as you view somebody's status update, you won't see that green ring, although you can still go in and view them again. So you go to the viewed section on the status tab, and then you'll be able to see their status updates that they've got. Now, an interesting thing that I saw on here too, which is something to keep in mind, is that when you view somebody's status, they can tell you've seen it unless you go in specifically and disable read receipts. So keep that in mind, that somebody will see that, yes, you did in fact look at their status. Next. Okay, so if you're on Android, iOS is much similar to this, but if you're on the phone, both parties, again, still have to be saved as contacts. Viewing status is basically the same as it is on the desktop. Next. But in this case, you can actually create a status. So you can create a status with photos or videos. You tap Updates, tap your profile photo, tap Gallery, and then you can choose one or more photos or videos. And then you tap the status contacts if you want to customize the audience who gets to see it, whether it's all your contacts or just selected contacts. And then you tap, I guess that's the send icon, and that will post your status update, and then the people that are on your contact list, they can actually see whatever it is that you posted. The iOS experience is very similar to it. There's slight differences in the user interface, but basically if you go to the URL that's on the screen there, and I think I also pasted it to the chat, it'll step you through step by step whether you're on Android, iOS, or desktop. Next. So what is it that I think is pros and cons? First off, keep in mind, this is a non-user who is talking about this. I've never used it at all, so I really don't know all of the nuances that may pop up on it. Next. So on the pros, I think it is a very simple way in order for you to share photos with your contacts in WhatsApp. Now, very simple to share photos. Well, if it's on your phone, it's very simple. If you don't already have the photo on your phone, you're going to have to somehow get it onto your phone before you can share it with contacts in WhatsApp. But I guess they're thinking if you're on the phone, you're sharing photos that you took with the phone. It is maintenance free, so I guess it's by default. Statuses will disappear after 24 hours. I don't know the steps you go through to change that to keep them there longer. And you can customize which of your contacts can see a status, so you don't have to share it with, you know, sort of your world of all of your contacts. Next. On the con side, you can only share with your WhatsApp contacts. Now, This isn't as big a con as I would really sort of expect, because most services that you can access over the internet, if you want to share with other people, the other people have to have an account on that particular service, or in this case, they have to be a WhatsApp user in order to be able to do the sharing on this. So it's very common that in order to be able to do this sharing, they have to actually be using the same functionality on their device. If you combine that with it disappearing after 24 hours, that may be a con, because there's no notification that happens that people on your contact list will get any kind of notification saying, oh, so-and-so has created a new status update. You would have to notice that in the profile list or the contact list that you got that green circle around one of the contacts. This is supposedly changing. So there is a link on there that talks about the what is changing. And I don't know if it's happening yet. This goes back to April of this year. But at that point, they were talking about the possibility that there would be additional ways of notifying your contacts of something new. Who knows if that's happened yet. And next. So what are the alternatives to using WhatsApp status to share photos? So you could use any cloud file sharing service like Google Photos, Google Drive, OneDrive, Dropbox, any of the ones that are out there. You could actually do the same thing on it. The pros is that, well, free cloud storage is readily available, typically anywhere in the range of 2 gigabytes up to 15 gigabytes is the biggest one I know of now. Actually, there is one that does a little bit larger than that on mobile only. But Google Drive will give you, or Google will give you 15 gigabytes free storage space. That is all of the Google properties, so it combines Google Mail, Gmail, your photos, any other files you have stored and so forth, all count towards that 15 gigabytes. But that's a pretty fair amount of space. On the pro side, the images won't disappear after 24 hours, and you can share it with anyone. Now, if you want to limit who can actually see it, that's a little bit different. But if you just want to share it with anybody who has the URL that you give them, then it's very easy to do it through any of the file sharing services. Next. On the con side, it is definitely more tedious. You know, WhatsApp does seem to make it really, really simple and quick to do it. A little bit more work to do it through any of the file sharing services. On the con side as well, others are not going to be notified of new postings, so you would have to actually send them an email or something telling them that there's something new there from the, that they can go see. You could run out of free cloud space. You know, a lot of people are pushing, you know, the amount of space that they have available on these cloud services. It's very easy to load up a whole bunch of stuff, and then all of a sudden you run out of space. And if you are sharing with specific people as opposed to anybody who has the link, then the other people have to have an account on the cloud service that is being used, which makes sense because in the case, authentication has to happen, and the only authentication available to that particular service is that particular service. And so they force you to have other people have an account on that service in order to be able to share specifically with them. But that does allow for notification as well, at least in Gmail's case, when you have that you're sharing with specific people, when you do the sharing, you actually have the ability to send them a notification at that time. They'll get an email with the link that they can use to then go see whatever it is that you posted there. Next. I think that's it.
That's it, Chris.
Yep.
Same thing on Dropbox. You can send notifications with Dropbox too.
Yep. Now, Natalie says Google Drive can only be shared with somebody with a Google account. You can share it also where anybody with the link can access it. So that's not a problem on doing that. You just have to set up the permissions such that, and I think that is the default actually for permissions, is that it's shared with anybody who has the link, and you just have to send them the URL and they'll be able to access it. If you want to limit it to specific people that also have the link, then that's when, yeah, they have to have a Google account as well.
Okay, so we're into the last 10. I've been posting in the chat if anybody has any other questions. And there's a question for Chris. Greg says he would like to know if the library presentation on how to buy a PC will cover laptops.
Yes, it does. In actual fact, the way that the presentation starts is with making the decision between a laptop and a desktop, because that's really sort of a fundamental difference. And a lot of your choices afterwards flow out of your decision as to whether you're doing it on a laptop or a desktop. And then throughout the presentation, I do talk about the differences between the two platforms. So, for example, you know, when I'm talking about storage, I'll say typically on a desktop computer, it'll come configured with, you know, a solid state drive of 1 terabyte or 2 terabytes and possibly a hard drive. On a laptop, you're more likely to get like a 512 gig solid state drive and no hard drive. So I talk about the differences on the two platforms as I go through each of the features that you should be considering when you're buying a new computer.
And can you post the URL into the chat for that, Chris?
Is that for the presentation file?
The OPL presentation.
Yeah.
The date and time and stuff.
Oh, the date and time?
Oh, just a link. The link to the...
Yeah, I can do that. I will go find it, and I will definitely post that.
Okay, Tom has a question about Logitech C920 HD webcams. It zooms right into his face, and he wants to zoom out. And you need the Logitech's utility, which I don't recall the name of it right now.
Yeah, if you look on the Logitech website for the C920, there will be a list of things you can get for it, and one of them is the software. I was kind of surprised, though, because I didn't have that. I've got a C920 HD as well, and I didn't run into that personally. I was looking at the Zoom settings for video, and you know, there are original ratio and HD, and on mine I've got both of those checked. I don't know what will happen if I switch. I don't particularly want to at this point in time, but there's not an awful lot you can do within Zoom to change it. So, yeah, it might be that your best bet is the Logitech software to actually take care of that.
No, I don't seem to have it on my laptop, Tom, so I can't tell you what the name is, but there's some utility somewhere that will let you play around with all the settings on your camera.
Okay, and I just pasted in the how to buy a PC. Monday, September 23rd, 6 p.m., Carlingwood. By the way, we Carlingwood, I deal with them directly when I'm setting up presentations. So the other branches have not yet selected the presentations they want. So there likely will be many more presentations that get posted probably in about 2 weeks. We'll have the list of presentations for the fall.
Okay, any other questions? We've got a couple of minutes if people have questions.
Timothy suggests sitting farther away from the camera.
<There you go. laughs> That'll work.
Yeah.
But I like to type. So my hands wouldn't reach. It's a laptop.
They have an answer for everything, don't they?
Natalie, I see I had trouble sending to someone overseas without Google. What were you trying to send?
For what it's worth, you can use WhatsApp to send files as well as pictures, and you can send videos too.
Okay, that's good to know.
And you can talk on the phone and, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Video.
So
you can do video calls.
A link to a Google Drive file. I'm really surprised that that didn't work anywhere in the world.
So maybe things have changed because my options were really just to send the link, and when I was putting in who it was, it had to have a Google account.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes. Now, that's if you want to restrict it to only that person being able to do it. But you know, when I'm sharing something through Google Drive, for somebody to happen across that file, just because they had the URL, is like, you know, what's the chance of that happening? Unless it's really sensitive information, I would just share it with the option that says specifically anybody who has the link can actually access it. So rather than restricting it to a particular person, I would actually just share it with anybody who has the link. That's the option within Google. So let me just go to my Drive.
So if you choose that instead of a specific person, do you also have the option for them not to be able to edit it or whatever, like they can just view it?
Yeah. So when you do a share, it comes up with, and you can have it either general access, anyone with the link, and then you can choose the option in the dropdown that they could be a reviewer, commenter, or editor. So that would allow them to actually edit it. But that would be anybody who has the link would be able to do whatever you choose there. The other way is people with access, where you add specific people, and for that, they need a Google account, yes.
Okay, so that's what I was doing, because I didn't realize you can restrict what they can do with the file if it's just general.
Yeah, by default, it will be anyone with the link, and it'll be viewer only, so they can only view the file.
Okay, that's great, thanks.
Yeah, and quite frankly, that's what I always choose, because I typically am not storing anything sensitive on Google Drive anyways. And so if they happen to give the URL to somebody else and somebody else can view the file, do I care? It's a lot easier to share it with it wide open rather than worrying about somebody having a Google account in order to be able to access it.
And Elton says you can, in WhatsApp, you can attach up to 10 photos or videos. And it's a great way to send a video that Gmail won't allow you because it's over 24 gig.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah. 24 gig, though, if you're, I mean, WhatsApp chat. Now, I guess there is the WhatsApp app on the desktop, but if it's from the, meg, okay, rather than gig, okay, 24 meg, that makes a little more sense. I was thinking, boy, if you've got 24 gig files on your phone that you're trying to share with other people, that's quite a stretch, but 24 meg, yeah, that makes sense, okay.
Yeah, 24 gig, you probably want to use Google Drive or Dropbox or something.
Something else, yeah.
Okay, I don't see any other questions, so let's wrap this thing up. If we can change the slide, can we change the slide? No, can't change the slide. Okay, then this last slide was saying that the next Q&A will be next Wednesday, which will be the 14th. So if you have any questions for next week, send them along to suggestion box. And as always, we will add you to the agenda. So I hope everybody enjoyed the presentations tonight. Thanks, everyone, for the contributions. And send us your questions for next week, and we'll see you on Wednesday.
Thanks, folks. Have a good evening.